All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam. We want to welcome you to Veterans Radio today. I'm really excited to have you here. We've got two guests that are going to be on. One is Christopher Brewer. He's a airborne ranger, all kinds of stuff. He's going to be talking about the training that he went through and some of the missions that he was on. So I'm really excited to have Chris on the program. And then we've got a one of our NVBDC interviews that my partner Jim Fausone did with Bill Elmore. And I'll talk about NVBDC a little bit more in a second. If you would like to get on in the conversation today, feel free to give us a call. The number is 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. I almost gave you my cell phone number. Before we get into the actual program, let me talk about our sponsors, because we can't do this program without them. We're really grateful to our corporate sponsors, and we're also grateful, of course, to you for your continued support of Veterans Radio. You know, we've been doing this program now since 2003, so it's a little over 1,100 programs that we've done, and we couldn't have ever, you know, done this without your support. So again, we thank you from the whole crew for Veterans Radio. So today, I want to make sure that we thank our major donors. Number one is Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. Remember, the NVBDC, what they do is, if you are a veteran-owned business and you want to work with the federal government or with many corporations, you need to become certified that says that you actually are a real live veteran-owned business. Evidently, there's some people out there that kind of fudge on that a little bit. So NVBDC is the people that can help you out do that. So give them a call. I'll give that number to you again, 888-237-8433. PuroClean. PuroClean are known as the paramedics of property damage. NH PuroClean office is independently owned and operated. In fact, they're one of the largest leading restoration franchise networks made up of entrepreneurs out there like you. And veterans get a 25% off their franchise fee. So for more information, go to thepuroclean.com. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. And finally, the Erwin Preschgorn American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to support Veterans Radio, which of course we would hope you would do, please go to our website, veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. And thank you for supporting Veterans Radio. Oh, I got a quick little announcement for you. I want you to mark your calendar. Mark your calendar for Sunday, September 28th. And that's going to be our fourth, I think it is, Radio on the River fundraiser. And it's going to be out at a place called Freedom River here in Michigan. And we've got Michigan Flight Museum is providing us with a Huey helicopter for people to get rides on. Yay. And we've got musicians are going to be there. Lem Genovese is a Vietnam veteran. He's going to be coming out doing some songs for you. We've got speakers. We've got food. We've got all kinds of things for you. So mark that calendar. Sunday, September 28th from, I think it's going to be 1 to 5. Is what it's going to be. So you can check it. It's on our website right there on the front page of our website. So I'll look forward to seeing you out there. That's Radio on the River, September 28th. It's not a home game for you people who are living in the Ann Arbor area. So it's okay. You can go out to the game, our game this time. All right. So let's get right into our interview here. And my first guest today is Christopher Brewer. And Christopher has written a number of books. He's an Army Ranger. He's Special Forces. He's a little bit of everything. The book is Old Scroll Ranger. And the second one that I read was called In the Shadows Between the Wars. So we're going to be talking with Chris about how he got into the military and some of the training that he had to go through. And then we're going to talk about some of the missions that he was on that we're allowed to talk about. We'll see. So joining me online right now is Christopher Brewer. Chris, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
All right. So tell me, take us back in time a little bit, and tell me, how did you get involved in the military to begin with?
Well, I was an Army brat. I grew up all my life moving from base to base. My father was in the Army, and it just was a natural transition. When I went to college, I went to what was that time North Georgia Military College. And like a lot of young people, I was tired of studying and struggling a bit with it, and saw some of the advertisements for Special Forces. So I enlisted in 20th Special Forces Group National Guard to help pay the bills. Got the bug. Saw something else later on about the 1st Ranger Battalion that was being activated, first full Ranger Battalion since World War II, and decided I wanted to be a part of it. So I went ahead and enlisted in the regular Army, joined the 1st Ranger Battalion in the middle of their activation test at Fort Stewart in 1974.
Okay. So you were at Fort Stewart then?
Correct.
Okay, that's where Hunter Airfield was?
Hunter is in Savannah.
I mean, are they close? I don't know. During the Vietnam era, they had flight schools, advanced flight schools at Fort Rucker, Alabama, and at Hunter Army Airfield outside of Savannah at the same time. So that's why I was trying to make that connection. Okay. So where did you do your basic training?
Did my basic training at Fort Pope, Louisiana. Went out to Fort Sam Houston for the medic training. Now, since I was only about 18, 19 years old at the time, the only thing I could do in Special Forces, the way they were configured in those days, was be a medic. Those were the only two trainings that I completed before the Rangers came up. And when the Rangers came up, again, being young and foolish, I decided I wanted to be an infantryman. So I insisted on going back to Fort Polk, Louisiana, to be an infantryman, and then to jump school, and then to the Ranger bat.
Okay. I had the privilege of going through Fort Polk for basic training myself. What a lovely area of the world. That's what I thought anyway. First place of the combat infantry man. I said, there's a mistake here. I'm supposed to be going to flight school. What are you doing sending me to this place? All right. So let's talk about the differences between, you know, you go through regular basic, and everybody who's been through at least the Army basic training is pretty much the same all across the country. But then you came back. Was that considered AIT for infantry?
Correct.
Okay. And then that's another 8 weeks of running around the swamps and stuff of Louisiana. And then off to Ranger School. Where was Ranger School?
Ranger School didn't happen until much later. At those days, for the Ranger Battalion, you'd come directly there. And then after a period of time, they would send you to Ranger School if they deemed you worthy. And that also at that time in the 70s, if you went into Ranger School as a PFC, you know, certainly as a Spec 4, you'd come out as a sergeant and you got promoted. So they wouldn't allow me to go to Ranger School until they decided that they wanted me to be a sergeant in the Ranger Battalion.
Okay. So in the meantime, did you go to jump school before Ranger School, or how did that work?
Yeah, you've got to be airborne qualified to be in the Ranger bat. So I picked up jump school en route. So I showed up there as a airborne qualified 5-jump PFC in the middle of their activation test, where they were pushing them as hard as they could possibly do so to see just how much a Ranger Battalion could take.
And one of the reasons in reading your book, we're talking here with Christopher Brewer, and one of the two books that we're going to talk about today is called Old Scroll Ranger. And in this, you were talking about how they wanted to remold American military after what had happened in Vietnam, and they wanted to kind of rebuild from the ground up almost, as far as Rangers were concerned and so forth. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, General Creighton Abrams felt that we had a lot of problems in the Army after Vietnam. There was a lot of drug use. We didn't have urinalysis back then. There were racial divisions. There was morale, especially the way Vietnam ended. Morale was really low Army-wide. Mm-hmm. So his thought was, we're going to form a Ranger battalion, get the best people we can in there, train them the way we want them to be, and then we're going to send them out throughout the Army as NCOs and officers to go ahead and bring the standards of the Army as a whole up. So after the first two, about the third year we were together, that started to happen. Everybody was there, one of the originals. They started going out to all the regular infantry units across the world.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, considering that this is also at the time where now we've got the volunteer army going.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was curious about that. And that, it made sense. I was thinking while I was reading the book about the morale going down, because everything, the Army doesn't live in a vacuum. Even in Vietnam, you could start seeing, especially toward the end of the Vietnam War, that the problems that we were having here at home were coming over, because they were, they were drafting anybody, anybody and everybody that was kind of left in the country, I think. And so some of those issues, as you mentioned, the drug use, the racial issues, some of insubordination and those types of things were going on even when I was in the service until I got home. And I think that the idea of, it's interesting to, that Creighton Abrams was a guy who did this whole thing.
Yeah, and we've got a quote from him in the preface of the book. That's the direct quote from Creighton Abrams, and that's the whole purpose of the Ranger Battalion in his mind. Now, it evolved into a lot more since then over the years, and the guys are young guys that are out of regiment or into things that we could have only dreamed of back in 74.
Okay. Yeah, he says, wherever the battalion goes, it will be apparent that it is the best.
And that was a standard. Yeah. And it actually was a little, the NCOs and the officers, every one of them had combat experience except for one guy. Most of them came out of the long-range reconnaissance patrol units, mm-hmm. SOG, Studies and Observation Group, Special Forces out of Vietnam. So that was a pretty impressive crew to come in as a young PFC, and those were all your leaders.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be. Some of those guys were, some of them were actually a little scary, but they were also very, very proficient in what they did.
Yeah, some of those guys were very scary, especially your PFC working for them.
I would think so. Yeah. I'm sure that before you had your own adventures, they had stories that would make the hair on the back of your neck stand on end, I'm sure.
Oh, and we'd hear them all too. It's kind of interesting. The fact there was one guy that had been an E-7 in Vietnam, one of those, and he was got a battlefield promotion, and he was the only second lieutenant in the Ranger Battalion. This was a guy who had been a sergeant first class Ranger LERP in Vietnam. And he's not your average second lieutenant. He actually had the guys in his platoon out there one day lined up with a table and a medic and an aid bag and a .22 caliber pistol. And his logic was that you have to know what it's like to be shot. He'd been shot many times. So if you've been shot, then it's not a shock when it happens to you and you can push on through it. So as he was explaining it to his guys, men, going to bring up here, I'm going to shoot you with this .22 caliber pistol, but just in the leg, just in the calf of the leg and the meaty part. And the medic here is going to take care of you. And you'll be excused from the run part of physical training for a whole week while you heal up. But this just so you know what it's like. And fortunately, the company commander was coming by and he kind of stepped in and said, no, I don't think we're going to do that today.
Oh, Ow.
To the immense relief of the guys in the platoon.
I can only imagine what was going through their minds at that time. What if he misses? What if he hits a bone? What if, you know?
Yeah, there's some question as to whether or not he just was kidding and doing that for effect, yeah. But boy, we sure believed him.
Oh, I can understand that. All right. So we've gone to jump school. You've gotten promoted already up to sergeant, which is pretty good right away. So where did we go from here?
Well, we came in and then the battalion went through a lot. We did our initial training. We did our activation tests. They experimented, all kinds of experiments. So we went to Fort Bragg and we basically walked for 3 days and three nights. And the only time we would stop is we'd stop, we'd dig a fighting position. As soon as it was done and done correctly, we'd fill it back in, we put our rucks on, we start walking again. We did that for 3 days, three nights without stop, no rest. And then we had a company live fire. And that was to see how men would respond and react under stress with all the training that we had. And great training, most of it with live ammunition. They emphasized that we're not playing around. This is live. You can kill somebody if you make a mistake. So every round has to be aimed. Every motion has to be calculated. You have to do exactly what we've taught you to do or you can get killed. And that was kind of a culmination there because I literally don't remember anything about that third night other than crawling for a while and then firing my weapon. Other than that, it was muscle memory. But then they took us on the road. So we went to a reforger in Germany. We worked against the 101st Airborne Division. We went from reforger to the Jungle Operations Training Course in Panama. And Rangers in the Jungle, there's a chapter in that in the book. Yeah. And then we went from there back to Fort Stewart, and we did an in-flight rig, flew all the way to Alaska in February, and jumped in up at Fairbanks, close to the Arctic Circle. And got a bit of winter warfare training. And then we went up above the Arctic Circle onto the North Slope and did a simulated attack on the pipeline. So that got us through all the various things that Rangers might do. And of course, with that, one of our primary missions was always airfield seizures. So we'd practice constantly to jump in and seize airports. And then we branched out. We started going to Halo School I was the first one to go to the Special Forces Underwater Operations Course with Scuba School.
Can I back you up just a little bit, Chris? And can we explain to our audience what some of these things that you were doing? I mean, this live fire thing got my attention. This is not, for those of you that went through basic, this is not the live thing where we crawled under the wire and they were shooting over our heads. You know, it seemed like it was right over the top of our heads, but I know it was like 9 feet or something. This is much more a close-in fire, isn't it?
Yeah, day and night. Usually when we were going to do a live fire exercise, we'd go out, we'd pick a section of forest or swamp or desert, whatever it was, and the standard was pretty much always the same, whether it was a defense or when it was an attack. First, we do a walkthrough, talk-through. Everybody would go out and we'd discuss what we were going to do, how we were going to do it. We'd practice that. Then we'd come back and we would do it a day with blanks. Then we'd critique that. If we had to practice anything else, we'd do that. Then we'd do it at night with blanks. Then we'd do it during the daytime with live ammunition. And then we would do it at night with live ammunition. Now you got to remember too, this was 1974, 1975. So we had one night vision device in each platoon. Most of us had no night vision at all. There was no flashlights. So if it was dark, it was real dark. And you'd have the muzzle flash from the weapons, and that was about it. So you had to know exactly where you were going to go. There were bullets that were coming past you because you'd run up between two guys firing, and you'd hit the ground, do your three-second rush, and they'd do their three-second rush, and the machine guns would be firing almost directly over your head. But they generally wait till you fell to the ground before they would fire. And we had mortars and we had 90 millimeters all going at the same time. So yeah, very possible to get killed on at least one occasion that I can recall. We almost did get somebody killed, but trained very hard to make sure that didn't happen.
Boy, that's not, That's really an intense training. I mean, that's whew. Plus, I know that you're running everywhere you seem to go, and and in the condition that, probably the best condition you've ever been in your life.
Yeah, it was the old days of running in jungle boots and t-shirts.
Yeah, no sneakers, shorts.
At Mondays were however far the battalion commander felt like running, and he loved 10 milers. So,
I'm glad mine like shorter distances than that. All right. So when you were doing these, all of these exercises, folks, as I said, we're talking with Christopher Brewer here. The book is Old Scroll Ranger. And we'll again explain that title there in a minute. But he goes into really great detail about what these training missions were all about. And, to me, I was exhausted just reading the book, because not only was he, in the swamps, down in Georgia and all that area down there, and he's down in Panama where, they have major bugs and creatures down there. And then he goes to Alaska to do the same thing, and he's in, 20, 30 below zero doing these things. So, I mean, you guys are, we're all over the world to just training for what? Any possible mission that could come up.
That was the idea. Whatever you could use an infantry battalion to do, they wanted us to be able to do it.
Wow. So, did you get deployed anywhere after your training, or where'd you go off to after that?
Well, later, yes. When I was in the battalion, the first 3 years, there were two times that we came very close. They were considering us for the Mayaguez rescue when they took that ship. Battalion commander at the time didn't feel that we hadn't done a lot of shipborne, so they sent the Marines instead. Later on, he told us he regretted that. He thought we would have done a better job, but we didn't actually deploy. In fact, I don't think the Ranger Battalion did any actual combat deployments that I'm aware of until Grenada. And that
Okay.
was well after I had left. I was an OCS when they went to Grenada.
Okay. So let's all right, I need to back you up here then a little bit. So in addition to all this incredible training that you're going through, you kind of make the decision, somebody asked you if you wanted to be an officer. What made that decision for you?
I went to Germany. I got out of service for a brief period, came back in after just a few months, and I re-enlisted for the 509th in Italy. I went over to Italy, great unit, had some good experiences there, went up to the 1st of the 10th Special Forces Group. Wasn't qualified, but they had something called platoon confidence training, and they were taking Rangers who'd come out of the battalion to be instructors there. So I got a much closer look at what Special Forces really does and really got the bug there. And I
Okay.
re-enlisted, made Sergeant First Class while I was over there, came back to Fort Benning, and I re-enlisted specifically for Ranger School at Fort Benning, because in my mind, I would go back. You always had to be an instructor at some point in your career. So I was going to be a Ranger instructor for a couple of years, and I was going to volunteer for Special Forces and go on to SF. Sergeant Major at the Ranger Department greeted me and said, "Welcome. Buy yourself a house. You'll be here for the rest of your career. So just go ahead and settle in." And I said, "No, Sergeant Major, you don't understand. I'm going to do my instructor time, but then I'm going on to other things." And he says, "No, you're not. You're at Fort Benning now. We're critically short of drill instructors. You will be selected to be a drill instructor since you're here. It's now a 5-year stabilized tour. They won't touch you for about 2 years, so you can do your commitment here, but then after that you'll go on the trail for five. That's 7 years. At that time I had about 9 years time of service. So you'll have 16 years time of service by the time you get off the trail. Might as well just come on back here for a couple of years. If we have to, we'll put you in the airborne department for a while and then you have your 20." And I went, "Oh, hell no."
Who wants to be a drill instructor for that long? Oh God, I would think that's the worst job in ever.
Well, no, nothing against drills. I mean, they
No,
do.
I'm not against them. I'm just saying it's the worst job. Nobody liked it.
It's a tough job. And, you
I
know,
would think.
If I'd have had to, I'd have gone and been a drill for a couple of years if I had to. But five, I wasn't seeing it. So I told him, I said, well, no, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go to SF. And he says, no, you're not. We're getting rid of SF. Big Army hated SF, and they're going to get rid of it. So,
Why
well, now.
didn't they like the special forces?
Big Army is really never like special forces because you've got guys that are out on their own doing their own thing. They're wearing different uniforms or no uniforms that doesn't fit into the Army structure, command structure, the way the Army sees it.
Okay, that makes sense because the special forces guys I worked with, I never knew that they were really special. I wasn't sure what they were. I didn't know if they were, regular army, if they had, if they were mercenaries or what, because they never showed up in the same outfit. It just.
And that's Big Army's attitude is what the hell are they doing? Where are they? Who told them to do that? Who gave them permission? And you'll read about that in the second book that, well, a lot of times no one gives you permission. You'll be way far away. And we can get into that a little bit later. But the bottom line is that once you go out on a special forces mission, quite often, especially in the 70s, you don't have a way to communicate and get specific instructions on what's happening. You just have to make a decision on the spot, move forward. And then when you get a chance, you communicate to the rear what's going on. But it's the guys that are in the field who are making strategic level decisions sometimes based on the things that they're doing. And that scares people to death. So at that time, they were going to get rid of SF. So, no, you're not going to SF. And I said, well, I'll go back to the Ranger Battalion. And he laughed at me and says, no, there's a 3-year waiting list for E7s trying to get in the Ranger Battalion. You're not going there. You're going to be a drill sergeant. The only thing that took priority was OCS. So I did the ultimate act of betrayal to the NCO Corps, and I volunteered to be a second lieutenant.
It must have taken years for them to start talking to you again. That's kind of like going over to the dark side.
Yeah, very much so.
Because, we all realize that the military, the armies, especially, it's kind of run by the NCOs. And that must have been really difficult just for you to go. I mean, you were older and to go into regular OCS school. And now you got to start go running around and having NCOs yell at you for the duration.
No, I was lucky when I came out. And yeah, I did have, but when I got a platoon in the 82nd Airborne Division, which is unusual, but I had a good record. So I got up there, had a first sergeant. First Sergeant Thomas Charo, who loved to yank the chain on new second lieutenants. And he came down to yank mine and basically told me, you better understand, young lieutenant, I don't like lieutenants. And I just looked up at him and said, yeah, First Sergeant, I don't like him much either. We ought to get along just fine. But he was a great first sergeant. We rubbed up against one another once in a while, but we worked a good working relationship. I had a good platoon sergeant. From there, at that time, if you were going to stay an officer in the Army, you had to have a 4-year degree. And I had 2 years, but not four. So I had to go to degree completion. And then I finally had the chance to volunteer for SF.
Okay. So now we're going to get into SF. So when that's interesting. When you talked about that in the book of that the Army sent you back to school. In essence, mm-hmm. for 2 years. Where did you go?
Campbell University in North Carolina,
okay.
Which was an interesting experience. It's a good university. It's a Baptist university. They wanted me to sign a statement that I would not enter any establishment that served alcohol or drink alcoholic beverages as long as I was a student. And I explained to the nice lady who wanted me to sign the statement that, ma'am, I'm 32 years old. I'm a newly divorced U.S. Army officer, and nobody said I had to become a Baptist to go to this school. And frankly, I'm feeling like having a beer right now. And that earned me a trip to the dean's office where we had to discuss that. But they all agreed that it'd probably be better if I didn't live in the dormitory. So I was allowed to get my own place off campus, and I stayed out there, and we got along fine.
I can see you sitting in the freshman dorm or something like that with the, you know, the 18-year-olds. So did you do school full-time until you got your degree?
Or was that... the Army gives you 18 months to complete 2 years worth of college. So take overloads, and there's no time off. You get it all done and get out.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about, and I'm talking with Chris Brewer here. He's written a couple of books that are really interesting for those of you like Rangers and Special Forces and so forth. One's called The Old Scroll Ranger. And let me go through that one first of all. It's Old Scroll Ranger. And I thought, mistakenly thinking, and I said, my goodness, what does he have, a typo on the cover title of his book? Could you explain the word scroll here and why it was important for you?
Sure. When we first formed up, the battalion commander and sergeant major designed their own shoulder patch. And they designed a scroll that said Airborne Ranger and then 75th Infantry down on the sides. And you see that on the cover.
Right. That's what I'm looking at it right now. Yes.
When 2nd Battalion was activated a few months after 1st, they didn't like the design that the 1st Battalion had come up with. So they designed their own. Also a scroll, but a little bit different. And then the Institute of Heraldry came down and said that, well, that's all well and good, but whatever you're going to wear has to be something we approve. And they sent down a patch that was similar to the old Merrill's Marauder patch, but nobody really liked that very much. So they went back and forth. And after a period of time, they finally settled on the scroll that the World War II Rangers wore, which simply says Ranger. And then it's got the regiment on the side and 75th Infantry. And that's what the guys wear now. So what you see on the book is the old scroll.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I like the old scroll. It's really nice. 1st Battalion, 75th Infantry on that one. All right. So let's move on to get you into the Special Forces. What is the difference, basically, the difference between being a Ranger and being Special Forces?
Rangers are light infantry, very well-trained, well-equipped light infantry, have very specific missions, but you've got privates all the way up through sergeants, majors, colonels within that battalion, and they operate as an infantry unit, whether it's squad, platoon, company, or full battalion. One of the primary missions for a Ranger unit is airfield seizure. If you absolutely positively have to put troops on the ground 1,500 miles away beyond the range that helicopters can reach, and you've got to do it right now, you need to seize an airport. So you send a Ranger battalion, they jump in on the airport, they seize the airport, and you start flooding an aircraft. That's one of the primary missions a Ranger bat does. They did very well in Grenada. They did it again in Panama. They still practice that to this very day. And of course, they do a lot of other things, but as organized units. Special Forces has a 12-man A-team. They've got a commission officer, a warrant officer, a team sergeant, an intel sergeant, two weapons sergeants, two engineer explosive sergeants, two medical sergeants, a total of 12 guys. And they will go well beyond where anybody else. They may be operating 1,500 miles away by themselves. If something goes wrong where they are, they're certainly not going to shoot their way out of it. So they're going to have to work with the people that are there where they're going. And that's the real nexus of what Special Forces is all about. You're going to go link up with a unit or a group of people in a foreign country. You're either going to help them form their own military, or you're going to help them train to do better at what they do, or find out what's going on. So Special Forces can do reconnaissance. They can do a direct action if it's something that a 12-man team could attack and destroy with only 12 guys, where you're going to go in, do it, and get back out. But really, their primary focus is we're going to work with foreign military or foreign people to help them organize and fight on their own. And that's the primary difference between Rangers and Special Forces.
Okay. Got it. It is, I mean, Special Forces seems to go in and doesn't want people to necessarily know that they're there.
Sometimes, and sometimes it's very public. And you'll see in the second book, I tried to put in examples of each of the different types of missions we did at that time. In those days, we had 5 doctrinal missions. Now I think they are up to something like 9. But direct action, think about a squad going and attacking a radar set or something and blowing it up. But that's that one specific thing that's got to be destroyed or captured and brought back. And they're going to sneak in, do it, and they're going to get right back out again. Special reconnaissance, 100 miles behind the enemy lines. They're going to hide, watch, report, and if necessary, they'll walk back out and escape and evade. A little bit more than what you would expect of Ranger privates. Mm-hmm. And then unconventional warfare is training a company or a battalion of people in a foreign country to organize into a military unit and fight themselves in their own war. But you're training them, advising them, working with them. Very similar to what you saw the guys do when we went into Afghanistan and they linked up with the Northern Alliance. Mm-hmm. FID is Foreign Internal Defense. We did a lot of that in 7th Group, where we'd go down and work with their military directly. There's a FID-type mission in the book where we helped set up a medical corpsman school. We taught the first few classes, and then we taught them how to be an instructor, and then we set up a school for them. And
you mentioned earlier, before we went on the air, we were talking about how many countries that Special Forces have been in, and I don't know if they're there now because we're not going to give away any secrets here. Mm. But how many countries have Special Forces been in the last 10 years, would you say?
Well, I'll tell you that when I was an officer in Special Forces in the 80s and 90s, on our briefing slides, we would routinely say that we were involved in about 132 to 136 countries at any given time. And it may not be a full 12-man team. It may be one guy that you sent out there. It might be 2 or 3. And that's the other thing that's different about Special Forces. And one reason is why conventional army really doesn't like it, because with that 12-man, what the army looks at as a squad, you've got a captain, a master sergeant, usually 3 or 4 sergeant first classes, and then E6s, and usually the lowest ranking man's an E5. And they see that as a waste of leadership. But the idea is that's going to help create and train and advise a battalion. And that's why you have the senior personnel.
Right. And you mentioned in the second book is called In the Shadows Between the Wars. And in here, you mentioned quite a few Special Forces operations. And they're all really interesting. And they're all, I see movies here in my head, going around and around. But you, not only were you in, Grenada, and then you were in Panama, but you also were in Colombia.
Yeah, I was not in Grenada. I missed that when I was in OCS.
That's right, yes.
We were in Colombia. Basically, I'd been on a job down in Costa Rica, came back home, and I was sitting down having a beer, watching TV, and I saw where the presidential candidate for Colombia, a man by the name of Galan, was assassinated by the narcos right on TV in the middle of a speech in front of a crowd. And I thought to myself, man, somebody's going to get a phone call. And I swear, phone rang at that moment. We were told to come in the next day. And the mission was to go to Colombia and set up a medical corpsman school. The Colombians at that time didn't have any field medics. So if they went on a patrol in the jungle and they got wounded, most times the guys would die because there was no one there to provide any type of emergency medical treatment. They'd have to walk back out. So President George Herbert Bush had stated that he was going to support Colombia against the narcos because a little drug war was starting to evolve, that we would not send combat troops, but we'd provide whatever logistical support they needed. Mm-hmm. when they sent the request up for the medical school that was going to be in Bogota, and Bogota at that time was having firefights or bombings every day, especially down in the south part of the city. So they couldn't really send the normal medical teams that they would provide to do that. So it came to special forces, but it had to be six medics. You've only got two medics on an A team. So that would have taken the medics from three A teams, and nobody wanted to do that. But I'd been a medic as a private. I had two fully qualified medics on my team. My intel sergeant had been a medic. My team sergeant could set up the trainer to learn how to be an instructor. And we'd take along our combo guy and we'd let him do the basic first aid and we'd supervise him. So, and we all spoke Spanish. I had a two plus level. So we got the job. But since no combat troops were going to go, according to the president, we were transferred on orders from Special Forces to the Security Assistance Training Management Office, SATMO, which put us in the same basket of people as all the doctors and nurses that would normally go. And then we flew down in civilian clothes with our uniforms and radios and whatever else we wanted for survival tucked away in our civilian luggage. And they gave us a pistol when we got there for self-defense and took us down to South Bogota where all the shooting was going on, dropped us off and said, good luck, guys. Let us know once a month that you're still alive. And this is the only ride we can give you from here on out. You're on your own. And we went to work.
Wow. And you did your job well. And you mentioned earlier on in our conversation that this was way before cell phones and communication was spotty at best.
We had a 74 Bravo high frequency radio that we put in our civilian luggage. And part of the idea of doing the SATMO thing was that we knew that the narcos had people in a lot of the government offices. So if we went down as Green Beret Special Forces, that would be seen on the air manifest. So we went down as medical personnel working for SATMO. So that helped. It wasn't a cover story per se, but that helped conceal the fact that we were Special Forces coming in from the bad guys, because there was a reward of, I think it was like $20,000 dead, $50,000 alive, if anyone would turn over a Green Beret to the narcos, because they were watching for us at that time. Mm-hmm. But that got us in and that got us set up. And then once we were there, over the 6 months we were there, the Mill Group decided to use us for other things.
I know you were sent out all over the country side in the book. I'm talking here with Christopher Brewer, and we're going to have to wrap this up, but this is In the Shadows Between the Wars, and jumped out of perfectly good airplanes for did halos, and did you do any halo jumps?
Wasn't military halo qualified, but I was in the 509th, we did some free fall for demonstrations and competitions. So I put a chapter in there that talks about what that's like, just so everybody could kind of get a feel for that. Yeah. Tried to put a little bit in the book that'll let you know a little bit about everything that Special Forces does, at least at that time.
I think it's important for our audience to understand that, you know, with all the different branches of the service and all of the different things that these branches do, that these two books, at least these two, and you said there's another one coming out after you became a civilian contractor, that I would encourage him to get. The one is called Old Scroll Ranger. The other one is called In the Shadows Between the Wars by Christopher Brewer, who retired major, correct?
Correct.
From the United States. How many years did you spend in the service?
24 years.
Okay, this guy knows what he's talking about, folks. And the books show that. And I encourage you to go. You can get them on Amazon. Probably get them most anywhere. That's where I got them. And they came in the next day. That was kind of cool. So, Chris, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. Let me know when the next one comes out. I'd like to find out more about that. Next adventure.
Okay. And the second one would be coming out in an audio book here soon. They're going through the final editing on that now if people are too busy to read.
Okay. No, we want them to read. Audiobooks are good. It's I'll tell you, both of them are great stories. The second one is more frightening than the first one. But anyway, thank you very much, Chris, for being on Veterans Radio. Look forward to talking to you sometime in the future.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to go right to Jim Falsone's interview with the NVBDC person, Bill Elmore, but right now you're going to be listening to our Medal of Honor. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. I'll be back after Jim's interview.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Welcome. I am Jim Fossone, and this is Veterans Radio's Spotlight on National Veteran Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC.org. Veterans Radio has a partnership with NVBDC. It is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses of all size. It's a 501c3 nonprofit established in 2013, so now a decade of certifying veteran-owned businesses to assist commercial and government buyers to make sure that they're actually working with legitimate veteran-owned businesses. It's a rigorous certification process designed to withstand the scrutiny of governmental and corporate entities seeking to utilize certified VOBs. And we're really pleased to have today on Veterans Radio, Bill Elmore. I'm going to give you more about Bill in a minute, but Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity.
So Bill is sort of the godfather of veteran-owned businesses, and he has been supporting veteran-owned businesses for his entire professional career. But let me back up a little bit to put some context around that. It starts as a simple kid who joins the United States Air Force and spends a little time in Texas, Illinois, Oklahoma. You go on after discharge to work at a couple of veteran-centric places, including the VA National Personnel Record Center in St. Louis. So many of us know that from the so-called Great Fire Destroying Records. You went on into further work as the executive director for the St. Louis Area Veteran Service Centers, You took some of that experience and said, hey, I'm going to help people retrieve their records from NPRC, and then found your way into the U.S. Small Business Association, or administration, I should say, SBA. And that's kind of where this story really starts.
Ultimately, I ended up creating, back in the 1980s, what was called the Veterans Entrepreneurship Training Program here in St. Louis. And in 2+ years, we trained almost 200 veterans and their spouses and their survivors, if they were widows, in entrepreneurship. And the program was incredibly successful. And the other thing it did for me was it exposed me to a whole community of already successful, mostly Vietnam veterans, that were in the business world in St. Louis, who in those days knew each other professionally, but none of them knew each other as veterans.
Yeah, I want to let me jump in here, because this is, veteran radio listeners, this is the start of what we see now 45 years later, where there are entrepreneurial boot camps and universities have specific programs to help veterans get into business, and government programs exist at the state, local, and federal levels. But in the 80s, in the late 70s and the early 80s, none of this existed, and even the concept of what a certified veteran-owned business didn't really exist, did it, Bill Elmore?
No, it did not exist, and I'll give you just a touch of history. The original 1944 GI Bill included small business lending for veterans. In December 1974, Congress deauthorized small business lending to veterans in the GI Bill. So for 30 years, we had a lot of help coming out of the federal sector for veteran entrepreneurs. In 74, when our generation came home and was coming home still, virtually all the assistance that had been delivered to previous generations of veterans disappeared.
We are talking to Bill Elmore. He was the founding associate administrator for the Veterans Business Development at the SBA, and the creator of the SBA Office of Veterans Business Development, and has seen this movement grow, and recently spoke at the NVBDC conference. Now, NVBDC, talking about how much this has grown, recently put out a report talking about the $1 billion roundtable and looking at veteran-owned, NVBDC-certified veteran-owned businesses, and the Business Roundtable reports something like $4.3 billion spend directed specifically to NVBDC-certified businesses.
Still can't hear me. How can you hear me now, right? Okay. That's what happened. So how much time have I got? 1 minute. Okay. So anyway, that was Jim Fasson talking with Bill Elmore from NVBDC. That whole interview will be able to hear in a podcast in the next couple of weeks. We're going to go out today like we usually do on God Bless America. This version, we're going to have Jimmy Fortune and Sonia Isaacs Yearly are the singers in this particular version. As you know, I love this song, and I love this country, and I think it's just helpful to us to know that there are many of us out here that want to know that we can preserve what we've got. And I think that that's really important. Next week, we're going to be talking, it's going to be Memorial Day. So we are going to be talking about what Memorial Day really is. And that, you know, it's to honor those that didn't come home. And so we're going to be talking about that. So we've got that, and we've got a number of things coming up. But anyway, we want to thank you all very much for listening. Until next week, you are dismissed.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies, to the oceans, white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, my home, sweet home.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with light from above. From the prairies, to the oceans, white with